You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
The trigger for the Arab Spring is a man named Mohamed Bouzizi, who lights himself on fire in central Tunisia. He's a vegetable vendor who is upset with the dictatorship he's living in. He lights himself on fire, and this triggers mass protests in Tunisia, which spread. It leads to the Syrian civil war. It leads to multiple regimes collapsing, all triggered by a single vegetable vendor.
That's Brian Kloss, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Brian Kloss on chaos, chance, and choice. As a kid, did you ever play What If? Like, what if the Kennedys, Dr. King, and Malcolm X weren't gunned down in the 1960s? Like, what if the votes in Florida were counted and Al Gore won the 2000 election? What if the U.S. did not support the jihadis in Afghanistan? What if the United States did not invade Iraq? History, the world, would have been very different. And on a personal level, what if your partner didn't take that job baking bread? You never would have met. What if you got stuck in traffic and missed your job interview? You get the point. Why do things happen? Random chance events can divert our lives and change everything. Social scientist Brian Kloss examines this phenomenon and the chaos it can sow. Our guest today is Brian Kloss. He's professor of global politics at University College London and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. He's the author of Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. He spoke at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. And now, Brian Kloss.
I'm just going to try to introduce you to some of the concepts in Fluke and sort of how I think about the world and why things happen and chance and chaos theory and contingency and all these great topics. So I'm going to start us off in 1926 in Kyoto, Japan. Basically, this couple goes on a vacation to Kyoto, Mr. and Mrs. H.L. Stimson, and they absolutely fall in love with the city. They sort of see the temples and the autumn leaves and everything, and they get a soft spot for Kyoto. Now, normally, you know, a vacation doesn't really change history, but in this instance, it did. And the Stimsons stayed at a place called the Miyako Hotel in Kyoto, Japan. And 19 years later, Mr. Henry Stimson, the husband in the couple, this is 1945, he ends up as America's Secretary of War. And he's the chief civilian in charge of overseeing where the first atomic bomb is going to be dropped. Now, the Target Committee, which is basically this group of generals and scientists and so on, they unanimously agree that the top target should be Kyoto. And it should be Kyoto because it has propaganda value, it has airplane factories, all sorts of reasons, but it's number one on the list. Now, Stimson doesn't want the city that his generals disparagingly call Stimson's pet city to be destroyed. And so he springs into action and he twice meets with President Truman in the Oval Office and convinces Truman to take Kyoto off of the targeting list. And so as a result of this intervention, the first bomb gets dropped on Hiroshima instead. Now, the second bomb is supposed to, this is Stimson meeting with Truman, and the second bomb is supposed to go to a place called Kokura. But when the bomber arrives over Kokura, there's this unforecasted cloud cover that happens to sort of align with the time the bomber arrives. And so they can't see the target. So they circle for a while. Eventually, they realize they're going to run out of fuel if they don't go to the secondary target. So they finally decide to go to the second target, which is Nagasaki. Now, this very bewildering state of affairs is that a 19-year-old tourist couple's vacation in 1926 and a cloud are ostensibly part of the story of why hundreds of thousands of people lived or died in two cities rather than two different cities. And this is effectively chaos theory in action in social systems, that really small, seemingly arbitrary, even random chance events can have profound consequences in reshaping our societies, but also in reshaping our own individual lives. And so to set this up again, I'm going to give you one other story. This is a sad story from 1905, closer to Carleton. This is from Keeler, Wisconsin. And pictured here, you have the woman on the screen in her wedding photo. Her name is Clara Maudlin Jansen. And Clara lived in this little farmhouse with her husband and four young children in Keeler, Wisconsin. And at one day, she just snaps. She has a mental breakdown. We don't know what it was, but she has a terrible mental breakdown. And in this fit of madness, she kills all four of her young children and then takes her own life. And so her husband comes home to find the whole family dead. And you can see the list of the four children on the same side of the gravestone. Very, very young, because this happened in 1905. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because this was my great-grandfather's first wife. And so my great-grandfather came home. He's pictured here in the front left. And he came home and found his whole family dead. Now, my great-grandfather remarried about a decade later to the woman that was my great-grandmother, and that produced the lineage that led to me. Now, I did not know about this until after Carleton. Actually, it was in my mid-20s that my dad told me about this. He showed me this newspaper clipping. And you sort of had this first reaction of, wow, this is an incredibly dark story in the family history. And then the second reaction is, but hold on, if these kids didn't die, I would not exist, right? And you start to realize that every joy, every experience, every relationship in your life is derived from this mass murder of children in 1905. This is true for me. But then I'm now going to loop you into this, because you wouldn't be listening to my voice if those children had not died, right? And so this is the aspects of chaos theory where so much of what we're told about the world is this neat and tidy story, and yet these wrinkles, these really distant, sometimes, sort of patterns of cause and effect can culminate in the way that our lives or our societies change over time. And I'm trying to take this idea seriously and say, how do we understand the world when I can be the byproduct of a mass murder and joyful experiences in my life can be derived from this terrible atrocity? Or how can we understand the world when the 20th century partly pivots on a vacation and a cloud? So the argument that I'm making is basically that everything is intertwined, that there's no part of the world that is unimportant, that literally everything that we do matters, and that every part of the world has meaning. So if that's true, that has profound philosophical implications and also profound implications for how we understand ourselves and our societies. And this is where chaos theory comes in. So some of you may have come across chaos theory in Jurassic Park, one of the first references in popular culture to it. But it's got a scientific basis, which is derived sometimes in shorthand. People think about the butterfly effect, this idea that a butterfly flapping its wings can, you know, cause a hurricane in a different part of the world. Now, what chaos theory actually means in the scientific analysis is what's called sensitivity to initial conditions. And basically what it means in layperson's terms is that a small effect in a chaotic system can have profound consequences as that system unfolds over time. This is why a butterfly flapping its wings can matter, or a tourist choice in 1926 can cause 100,000 different people to die in 1945. Now, the origin of chaos theory is one that I think take very, very seriously when we contemplate the world of science fiction. So for example, if we think about traveling back in time, whether it's in a book or a film or whatever it is, we all sort of accept the logic of time travel that you shouldn't touch anything, right? Like, don't talk to the wrong people. Don't squish any bugs a million years ago, because maybe humans won't exist if you do that. Maybe you won't exist if you talk to a friend of your parents and they'll never meet. Now, what's weird about this is that we never apply that same logic to the present, right? So if squishing a bug a million years ago can delete humanity, then squishing a bug today is also going to affect the trajectory of the world, just as having a conversation today is also going to affect the trajectory of the world. And there's this weird asymmetry between how we think about cause and effect relationships in the past, where we apply chaos theory and intuitively understand it, and how we think about the world in the present, where we just imagine chaos theory doesn't exist. And so there's this sort of odd dynamic here where I think the past, the way we think about the past, is correct, that these literal, there is literally this ever-branching, infinite world of possibility. I use this phrase from a Borges short story from the 1940s called The Garden of Forking Paths. and that every single thing that we do, every step we take, is diverting the path that is available to us in the future. And that's a sort of shorthand for chaos theory. Now, nicely, it came from World War II as well. We're going to reconnect to that period that I talked about at the beginning, because the origin story of chaos theory is from a man named Edward Norton Lorenz, who was a meteorologist in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And I couldn't find with certainty whether he was involved in forecasting the clouds over Kokura, which caused the bombing of Nagasaki, but it's likely that he probably was. And after the war, he was upset at the limits of meteorological forecasting. So he tried to make it more rigorous and scientific. So he designed this new program on this very rudimentary computer in the 1960s. And he tried to create a weather system that had just 12 variables. So it had, you know, a series of very simple ideas, wind speed, temperature, whatever it was. And one day he decides to rerun a simulation halfway through. And he figures, you know, if I just plug in the values from halfway through the simulation and restart it, I'll get the same effects because I'm just going to type in exactly what it was originally. Now, he does this, and the outcomes in the weather systems are radically different, not like marginally changed, but a blue sky day has become a thunderstorm. And he thinks he's made a typo, right? So he checks the data over and over, and there's no typos. So eventually what he does, he discovers that the problem is that the computer printout that he's using is truncating the values to 3 decimal places. So if the real wind speed is 1.234567, it's actually printing it out as 1.234. And when he was plugging in 1.234, it was an infinitesimal bit off. And what he discovered is that these tiny rounding errors of the 4th, 5th, 6th, and, you know, beyond decimal places was reshaping the weather weeks into the future. And this is the origin story of chaos theory. It's the revelation that in chaotic systems like the weather, if you have any error whatsoever in the measurement, it will produce wildly inaccurate forecasts beyond a certain point, which is why today we all understand chaos theory in the sense that we don't take weather forecasts seriously beyond about 7 to 10 days. And no matter how good the supercomputers get, that's probably a pretty hard limit because the system is so chaotic and so complex. Now, this is where you have the butterfly effect and this idea of the hurricanes coming through and all this sort of ideas. But I think it also extends to wider aspects of society. And this philosophical interpretation, I tried to grapple with what this means. What does it mean if all these tiny little details can profoundly reshape our world? And it's this quote that I modified from a complex systems theorist, Scott Page, where it says, "We control nothing, but we influence everything." It's a subtle reorientation of the way we understand the world, where everything is important. We can't control anything because tiny little details will sway our trajectories, but we will constantly influence the trajectory of the world of the people around us, and the lives of 8 billion of us is sort of constantly being rewritten by everything we do. Now, this gives rise to another world of scientific thought around these lines of what's called contingency versus convergence in evolutionary theory. So this is where I borrow heavily from the world of evolutionary biology. And basically, the contingency worldview is that sort of stuff happens. And the convergence worldview is sort of like everything happens for a reason. When it comes to why species emerge or why a certain trait emerges in evolutionary biology, there's this raging debate. And I'll give you some examples of sort of the ways in which we might understand this. This is contingency. When you look at the history of the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, the best scientific understanding suggests that it hit at exactly the worst place for the dinosaurs. It was flung, according to good scientific theories that exist right now, our understanding is that the rock that hit the Earth was flung out from a brief oscillation in the Oort cloud in the distant reaches of space. This shot the asteroid towards the Earth, and it hit off the Yucatan Peninsula in this really gypsum-rich rock, which meant that there was this cloud of toxic gas in addition to the extremely high temperatures. It was about the same temperature as what we broil a chicken in the oven, right? So it killed lots and lots of stuff instantly with the heat, and then the gases killed much more. And so almost everything that survived could either dig or swim. And pretty much all of the animal life that exists either was a digger or a swimmer. If you think about this, if the asteroid had been delayed on its trajectory by a few seconds or a minute, let's say, it would have either hit a different part of the Earth and probably not killed all the dinosaurs, or it would have not hit the Earth at all. And the dinosaurs dying is the origin story of mammals rising. So this is where humans come from. And the ultimate contingency in my mind is that if the space rock had been 1 second delayed, we probably would not exist. So that's the evolutionary biology sort of, you know, epitome of contingency. But for this tiny shift, everything changes. Now, the alternative is that the world is not fully chaotic. As we all know, there's order and patterns in our systems. And so this is where the realm of convergence exists. Now, if you were to take the eye of an octopus and put it next to the eye of a human, which I don't recommend doing at home, but if you were to do this, you would have an astonishment at the fact that the octopus eye and the human eye are almost exactly the same. And the structure is almost exactly the same. Now, this is very weird because evolutionarily, the cephalopods, which are what the octopus are, the family of species that they're in, they diverged from our family of species 600 odd million years ago. And what happened was nature basically solved the same problem twice in the same way. So vision happens to be a very adaptive strategy to survive long enough to have children, which is the engine of evolution. And so nature solved the same problem by producing the same kind of eye twice. And so this is convergence. This is the idea that some stuff just works. And so the patterns and the order and the structures create replicability. Right. So it's not just the 1 second and everything is different. It's actually that, OK, 600 million years, you still end up with the same kind of eye. And what I'm using these frameworks for us is that our world is basically what I call contingent convergence, that there are these moments where everything shifts in an instant. And there's also these moments where you can predict some of the patterns, some of the unfolding of behavior and trajectories, because some stuff just works and some stuff doesn't. And we inhabit a world between them, between contingency and convergence. Now, the really weird thing about this is that if you think about chaos theory in your own life, and we bring it away from the sort of abstract notions of weather systems or octopuses, I coined this phrase called the snooze button effect. And it's basically this idea where if you imagine waking up tomorrow morning and you're a little tired and you slap the snooze button, and then your life rewinds by 5 seconds, and in this version of events, you don't hit the snooze button. I think it's obvious to all of us that our world is going to be a little different, right? You're going to have slightly different questions and answers that you have in a conversation. You're going to talk to different people. You might meet different people that day. And the snowball effects of those sort of ripples from that difference of 5 minutes might lead to a different job in 5 years. It might lead to a different friendship. It might lead to all sorts of different changes in your life. Now, we will never see these, right? We only have one snapshot of the world, which is our reality. So we can only imagine the what ifs. But my argument is that these little things are constantly diverting our trajectories, that every snooze button, every conversation, every interaction is slightly recalibrating the trajectory of our lives. Now, when people take issue with this and they say, nah, it all gets sort of washed out in the end, I think I have one example where I think it's impossible to argue with the logic. And it's the moment that a child is conceived. Now, I will not go into graphic detail here, but when you think about this, if the moment a child is conceived is even different by a millisecond, you have a different kid, right? Now, take that backwards in the day. That means that if you stop and have a sip of coffee on that day, you've got a different child, compared to if you don't stop to have a sip of coffee. But that's true for everything, right? It's not just that day. It's that everything had to be exactly as it was in your life for the moment of conception to be in that exact instant. And so every single thing in your life up to that moment culminated in the ultimate outcome of having a child, that exact child. And so this is contingency on steroids, right? That your life will obviously be profoundly different if there is a second or a millisecond change in the moment of conception. And I don't think there's something miraculously different in terms of cause and effect dynamics between the moment of conception and everything else that we experience in life. I think that the cause and effect dynamics are the same. It's just that it's invisible to us that these little changes are adding up to profound consequences. And every so often, when we think about them in the life-altering dynamics, like having a kid, it's obvious that these little changes can be profoundly and bewilderingly moving in terms of how we shape our lives. So the question then becomes, why do we pretend otherwise, right? Why do we sort of have all these models and systems where the contingency is basically ruled out or ironed out, And the model has a neat and tidy story that tells you how the world works. So why do we basically ignore contingency in intellectual history? Or more commonly, if you think about like Nate Silver, why are we told to focus on the signal and ignore the noise, which is to a large degree the antithesis of what my argument is, because the noise matters in my view. Now, when you think about things like the scientific revolution, before the scientific revolution, you know the laws of physics and so on, when things happened, there wasn't much of a good way to explain why they happened other than God, right? Before the scientific revolution, you could sort of say like, look, the world unfolds in this really mysterious way. We can't understand it. Physics provides some of the answers, right? That all of a sudden you say, where will this ball land if I throw it? Well, Isaac Newton's equations help us answer that question. And classical physics gives us this sense for the first time of real control over the world rather than sort of just mystical awe of, you know, God and his plan. So you start to get this change after the scientific revolution where we just imagine if we get better and better equations, we will control the world, and therefore the world is controllable. It's just ignorance that's the problem. There are other people who have argued against that view in science, and one of them is the man pictured on screen named Motu Kimura, who many people outside of evolutionary biology will not know, but he's the person who basically came up with what's called the neutral theory of molecular biology, which basically argues that a lot of mutations in DNA are not advantageous or bad for us. They're just neutral. They're neither good nor bad, right? It's just sort of random. And this theory upended a lot of the precepts of evolutionary biology. He's one of the major figures in science who's sort of taking issue with this sort of worldview of control and patterns and so on, and saying, actually, a lot of the world is pretty arbitrary. Now, Motu Kimura ends up illustrating his own points in his life, because when Motu Kimura was growing up, he wanted to avoid conscription in the Japanese military, and so he decided to enroll in the University of Kyoto in 1944. And in 1945, when Stimson was telling Truman not to drop the bomb in Kyoto, Motu Kimura was a student there, and had this vacation happened differently in 1926, Motu Kimura probably would have been incinerated in the first atomic bomb. So this is, again, an illustration of how even intellectual history can be contingent on the smallest of details from other parts of the world, distant histories that we don't even know are connected. There's another question that we have to tackle, which is, why do we as humans just gravitate towards explanations that are sort of what I call the storybook reality, the sort of storybook, neat and tidy story of how things work, which often eliminates the contingency and emphasizes the convergence? And this is where our brains have evolved to be what Jonathan Gottschall, a great scholar, has called the storytelling animal. The idea is that our brains have evolved to make sense of reality through stories. And there's good reasons for that. One of them is, if you think about the perils of the world, there is a much greater cost to basically it's much better to overemphasize patterns than to underemphasize them. And I'll give you an example with a saber-toothed tiger from, say, the hunter-gatherer period of humanity, which is, if you see a rustling in the grass, right, the grass is sort of moving, you think to yourself, that could just be random bits of wind, or it could be a saber-toothed tiger. If you think it's a saber-toothed tiger and you run away, and it turns out to just be wind, then all you've done is wasted a bit of energy. On the other hand, if you say, it's probably just rustling grass from the wind, and it turns out to be a saber-toothed tiger, you will die. And therefore, evolution has basically made it so that the adaptive features of our brains are ones that over-detect patterns and cause and effect rather than under-detecting them. It's adaptive for our survival. So we have inside of our skulls what is effectively a pattern detection machine. And it goes on overdrive in ways that are sometimes very damaging. But it's also how we make sense of the world. So one of the examples closer to where I am outside of London is from the Blitz, when they were dropping bombs on London in World War II. Now, if you look at the map of where bombs were falling, imagine you're a Londoner, death is falling from the sky, you have no way to predict it. You try to grapple with something that might make sense of this. So they try to map where the bombs are falling. So you look at this and you say, okay, there's, you know, 4 bombs in the top right quadrant, 31 in the bottom right. No way am I going to go to the bottom right, right? That makes sense. Let's try to avoid the place with most bombs, and we'll go to the place with the fewest bombs. The problem is, this makes sense until the lines are drawn slightly differently. which is completely arbitrary, and now the pattern doesn't exist. Now the area that's the top right actually looks about as safe as everywhere else, right? And maybe even the top part is actually the safest with 10 bombs instead of 18 in the right and 23 in the bottom. So our brains are evolved to basically make sense of data and make sense of the world around us in neat and tidy ways, and often they're not the right ways. Now, when you look at the actual bombs that were dropped, it's a completely random spread. There was no way to avoid this. But what actually happened in World War II is that the Londoners became extremely superstitious because they had no other way of asserting control. So they imagined, oh, if I put my lucky socks on, I won't die today. And superstition is still extremely prevalent in areas of the world where we have less of a sense of control over our destiny. So in places with extreme poverty, war, famine, et cetera, superstition rises, whereas in more comfortable places, it falls because you have other mechanisms to believe that you can control the world. Now, this is tied to what's called narrative bias, the idea that we make sense of reality by telling stories where we stitch together X causing Y. This bleeds into our fiction, because if you think about the idea of Harry Potter and how it's going to end, right? We all know there's this showdown between Harry Potter and Voldemort. We don't know what's going to happen as we're reading the books. But I will tell you there's one thing that every reader probably understands and would predict, which is that no matter how this is going to be resolved, Harry Potter is not going to defeat Voldemort because Voldemort slips on a banana peel and dies. Right? It would be so unbelievably unsatisfying to have a random outcome or he like trips and falls off a cliff. So our fiction has to tell stories that make sense. But the world isn't like that. The world is full of these sort of random and arbitrary details. And my favorite example of this, because I'm a nerd who likes to read murder mysteries to sort of unwind, murder mysteries are the perfect example of narrative bias. It's a million seemingly unconnected data points. And then the big thing, the payoff that you wait for is in the last 10 pages, you know, Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot comes in and all of a sudden every detail makes sense. It all fits together like a perfect puzzle. And that's so satisfying for our brains precisely because we hate disorder and we want everything to make sense. The murder mysteries that don't resolve, all the details flop because they don't fit in with how our brains have evolved to try to crave bringing order to disorder in the world. So this creates this sort of dynamic of, you know, over detecting patterns, as I said before. Now, this is the quote from Jonathan Gottschall about the Voldemort not dying from the banana peel. Now, one of the things that I want to get into is briefly about the sort of nature of these sort of fluky events that sometimes upend our world and why these seem to be becoming more common. I do think that we have made ourselves more prone to the sort of chance, small changes creating profound effects because of the nature of modern social systems. And now I'm borrowing not from evolutionary biology, but from the realm of physics and what's called the sandpile model. Now, it's a very complicated mathematical model, but it's very simple to understand in sort of what the gist of it is. So if I take one grain of sand and I add it to another and another and another, eventually I'll get a pile. Eventually, that pile will get tall enough that a single grain of sand will cause an avalanche, right? Now, what caused the avalanche? The answer is every grain of sand. But the trigger was the last one, right? So this is sort of the idea of systems being stretched to their absolute limit. The sand pile is a metaphor for that happening. And we can see that in historical examples. So in World War I, you have a sand pile that grows really, really tall right before the onset of World War I, because all these alliances, all these interconnected, entangled alliances exist, such that when a single person is assassinated, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand is assassinated in Sarajevo, it triggers the war, right? And it triggers it through one fluke, which is that the car that he's in breaks down right in front of the would-be assassin, Gavrilo Princip, who then shoots him. But then if you look at the story even more in depth, this is something that I haven't seen a lot written about, is 9 months before the Archduke went to Sarajevo, where he was assassinated, he went on a hunting expedition to Welbeck Abbey, a few hundred miles from where I am now. And in this hunting expedition, the person loading the shotgun slipped on a fresh coat of snow, and the gun went off, and it almost hit the Archduke. It missed him by about 3 inches. It missed his head. So I don't know what would have happened if he had died 9 months earlier at Welbeck Abbey in England rather than in Sarajevo from an assassination. But World War One may or may not still have happened, but it would have unfolded differently. And so this is where I think these aspects of the sandpile model fit in with chaos theory, that you can have a system that's stretched to its absolute limit. The sandpile is really tall so that any little extra grain will cause an avalanche.